Hey there, podcast listeners. It's Courtney here with a special offer just for you. My new book is coming out in April. It's called Looking Up, A Birder's Guide to Hope Through Grief. It's all about grief and sorrow and the ways that birds and birding can bring us to a place of hope. It's a book of faith. It's a book of humor. We would love to give you a 20% discount. You can use this code, IVPPOD20. That's IVPPOD20. That code will give you 20% off and free shipping anywhere in the US when you order from ivpress.com. Pick up your copy of Looking Up, A Birder's Guide to Hope Through Grief today. Hope is the thing with feathers.
Hope is the thing with feathers.
That's like a bird.
Like a bird.
That perches in the soul.
That perches in the soul. Welcome to the Thing with Feathers podcast, a podcast about birds and hope. I'm your host, birding enthusiast, Courtney Ellis. Welcome back to the Thing with Feathers podcast. I feel like we have a true birding celebrity on the show today. Today with us, we have Adele Schwaderer. She is the Cape May Bird Observatory's program coordinator. She is a naturalist. I visited the Cape May Bird Festival for the first time this fall in October, and it changed my life. Adele, thank you for being here.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for having me, Courtney. This is going to be really fun. I already know it. So thanks so much.
I'm so excited to have you here. Before we get into all the Cape May goodness, tell us a little bit about you, who you are and what you do.
Yeah. So like you said, I'm the program coordinator for the Bird Observatory. I officially started with the Bird Observatory and New Jersey Audubon full time back in June of 2022. So I'm about a year and a half into my job. But previously I was a naturalist. I was an interpretive naturalist for them, which is spending time in the fall talking to all of our visitors at the multiple migration watches we have about, you know, why we're counting birds and why we should keep counting them. And then I was the George Myers Naturalist, which is a 9-month position through New Jersey Audubon with the Bird Observatory and the Nature Center. So I really got not only more exposure to why Cape May is so cool with birds and the aquatic life here, but also I really fell in love with the group of people that live in Cape May and the true birding community that is fostered here, because it's such a cool, unique landscape, and the fall migration season really is just something to behold. So then the pandemic happened and I was still living here, but then I was given the opportunity to go back to grad school. And I'm still currently finishing up my dual degree in environmental education and parks and resource management from Slippery Rock University, which is in Western Pennsylvania, which is where I'm from originally. I guess in bird years, I'm probably still like a newer birder. Like I have met other people that are my age that have been birding since they were kids. And I've always loved the outdoors. I always loved learning more and kind of being out in nature and kind of observing. But I didn't get into birding until I was a junior in college. And I worked at Hawk Mountain Sanctuary for the first time. And that really opened my eyes to the world of raptor migration. And I couldn't get enough. So that's kind of how I ended up here, is I've met so many great people that have helped steered me and help cultivate my love of birding and let me know that if I really wanted to be a outdoor educator and even have it be bird focused, it was a possibility. So I feel so grateful to be here. And I love talking about birds. So this is a very fun opportunity. So again, thank you so much.
It's so good to have you here. So we have listeners all over the country, but also 20 different countries. Tell us, what is so special when it comes to bird migration? What's so special, particularly about the Cape May area? Because it's really unique.
Yes, it is crazy to think about how just the abundance of birds that really pass through Cape May, whether they just fly overhead or if they actually touch down and kind of spend time in Cape May County refueling on their southbound migration. But really what makes Cape May so unique is the geography. So if you've ever looked at a map of the East Coast, you'll notice that New Jersey is the first southbound facing peninsula. So all of these birds are in the fall, they are getting cues that they need to leave. So either it's weather's getting colder, their prey is becoming less easily accessible, and also the days getting shorter. So they really are getting those cues that like, oh, I gotta go, I gotta get out of here. And additionally, they can't just hop on a plane or like get in a car to get where they need to go. So they really want to try to save as much energy as possible. So, and it's, and migrating even just a few hundred miles can be super dangerous for birds. You know, not only do they have to watch out for predators along the way, but they have to make sure they eat eat some food, you know, to really help bolster their energy to get them there. But also there are things like cars and power lines and all other kinds of, you know, cats, you know, things that they will encounter that they are much more easily susceptible to in an area they don't know. So they really want to get extra help from the environment. So whenever there's a nice northwest wind, that is really what helps push them south. So it's a wind that is coming from up north. So it's cold and it's pushing them in a southeasterly direction. So it really is a nice tailwind to help them really get where they're going. If they are songbirds, then they are migrating at night. So they're doing that because there are less predators around, but also there is no sun. So it helps them save up more of the energy, because unlike larger birds like our raptors that we count in Cape May at the state park, they are soaring lots of the time. So they can use thermals and glide. And the more that birds have to beat their wings, the more calories they burn. So really, all of those birds kind of get funneled down. So whether they are songbirds or raptors, they're getting pushed either overnight or during the day. And so lots of the birds that we actually count on migration, this is their first time ever migrating. So if you think about it, these birds, they were born in May, June, July, maybe. And then they not only need to learn how to fend for themselves, they need to learn how to fly, and then they need to learn how to get south for the winter. And let alone these birds don't know a lot of things, but they also, as they're flying, they don't know that the ocean exists. So they are flying in that southeasterly direction. They're being pushed that way, and then they hit north of us, the coast. And a lot of birds, like whether they're smaller, they don't want to be lost out over the ocean, because if they hit the surface of the water, then that's it for them. You know, they can't get back up. And there's lots of gulls and like other birds that would love to snack on a little songbird out over the water. As well as if you are a raptor, there aren't thermals out over the water. A thermal is a hot column of air that is rising up, which helps the birds save energy. Like I mentioned, they can glide and not flap their wings as much. So they start riding the coast all the way down, and then they hit Land's End, or down here in Cape May, where, you know, the southernmost point in New Jersey. And so now they're not only faced with the ocean on one side, but also the Delaware Bay on the other, which is, I think at its shortest, it's 13 miles. At its widest, it's 17 miles across to Delaware. Some birds will make that crossing, like the peregrine falcon or ospreys, who really aren't afraid of water or of speed. Certain other birds like great blue herons and egrets, if they catch a big enough tailwind, they'll also go. But lots of birds really don't want to challenge that large expanse of water if they don't have to. So then the birds will kind of either put down and kind of figure out what's going on, or they will just continue northward up the Delaware Bay to then cross the bay at a more narrow point. So that's really what makes Cape May so special, is this funneling action that happens in the fall on top of the variety of habitats we have. So we have marsh, we have forest, we have meadows, we have all kinds of stuff. So there's a really, in such a small area, a wide variety of food and shelter resources for birds. So it can really bring them in here. So all of the birds that we see in the fall, it's really not their first choice to be here, because they'd rather be more inland away from water. But they really, you know, it's a tough a tough go out there. So most of the time, like if you look at our numbers on Trektelen, which is the online database that we input all of our or our counters, I should say, put up our daily counts. You can check them live. But we also, because we use a tablet now and not paper data sheets, we can actually age the raptors. And so if you look, most of our Sharpshin Hawks and Cooper's Hawks are first year birds. Like they, our counters will note where we can whenever birds are juvenile or in that first year of life. So yeah, that was kind of a long answer to why KMA is so special, but that's really what it's multifaceted with the funneling action, but also we're so lucky to have so many different areas here that are rich with resources for birds. So
it's really, it's such an astonishing place. I'm a birder here in Southern California, and I hoped to add like 10 birds to my life list when I was out there, and I ended up adding 32. I mean, the diversity alone was just astonishing. Yeah. And, you know, it kind of functions as this cul-de-sac. We live on a cul-de-sac, and we always get people who think they're going to drive through and they don't, and they turn around, and that's Cape May for a lot of these birds. They're like, yes, wait, hang on, hang on.
That's smart. I've never thought to use that. It is like a cul-de-sac. Like it's like, oh, you gotta turn around, or you gotta, I don't know, bust through someone's yard, which would be a horrible, you don't want to do that, which is the same thing as trying to go over the Delaware Bay. It's pretty risky. Like you could, but would you want to, you know what I mean?
So. Right. We all make choices. We all make choices.
Yes. We all have choices, so, you know? Yeah.
One of the things that just astonished me about this birding festival is I'm a fairly new birder. I really started during the pandemic 2020. So I'm starting my fourth year into birding. And, you know, I think I'm getting okay at bird ID and things like this. But then I went to this festival and I stood with many of you at the Sea Watch and at the Morning Watch. And you all would look at these birds that were so small, they were like a piece of cracked pepper on a tablecloth. And you'd say, oh, that's a sharp-shinned hawk. And I would say, you are full of it. There's no way. And then the bird would come closer and we'd all see it with our binoculars. And sure enough, mm-hmm. So thank you for helping me see what is possible. Tell us a little bit more about how you learn to see birds specifically. I know you've led the raptor ID workshop for many years at the festival. Yes. What is a raptor? How in the world can you tell them apart when they're the size of a piece of pepper?
Of course. So, so a raptor, specifically is a, well, this is funny. This is the funny thing is they are birds of prey, but technically any, like a robin is also a bird of prey because it eats more than just berries and, like vegetation. It also eats like worms and things like that. So raptors specifically, the word raptor comes from the word, rapier in Latin, which is to grab. So raptors mainly, seize prey with their feet and their sharp talons to catch their prey. And then they use their sharp hooked beaks for killing. So that's kind of what sets them apart are their sharp talons and their curved hooked sharp beaks because they don't carry like sporks in their pocket to eat things. So they gotta grab some.
They really
of their talons.
Should.
I know. Wouldn't that? I think birds should wear name tags, and also, you know, utensils would also be very helpful to them. So that someone should let them know. But yeah, so that's kind of what sets them apart. And I always, normally, whenever I do the raptor ID talk, I talk about vultures last, and they are also technically in the raptor realm. But as some of you may know, vultures are scavengers. And for a while, they were taxonomically placed with storks since they don't use their feet in the same way. But now they're back with the raptors, which is where I think they should stay, honestly. However, you know, people love to switch stuff around, you know, with DNA and like sorting and all kinds of stuff. But so they use their feet slightly different. But all of the other raptors in the group, that's really what sets them apart. Before I kind of dive into like specifics, what I think is super great about birding in general is normally wherever you go, no matter how big or large, there are groups of people that also love birding. And that's really like I didn't really get into birding till college, like I mentioned. So, and the reason why I was able to learn so quickly is I was doing various seasonal jobs where either other people that I was working with were also really into birds or my my supervisors and like other people that were working for the places I worked were so great in like taking me under their wing and spending time with me. And I just was learning so much just from going out in the field. So I know it can be scary. I can think of a lot of different times in my early birding career where if someone would have said something weird to me about not being good at birding, or if I would have just put myself in a difficult situation where people wouldn't have been willing to help me, I think it really could have turned me off. But I've really found that a lot of people are just so willing to share new information. So I know it can be scary to like go to a new bird walk or to go out there and try your best. But I think like first and foremost, like getting out there as much as you can and meeting people you trust to tell you their knowledge and really point out things to you and be kind in their explanation of the natural world is what really helped me. So, but in general, with bird ID, not just with raptors, I find that whenever you're first getting into birding, you really want to grab on to things like size and color, because obviously you're looking at your book and it's like, wow, like the cardinal, it's just so bright red, and like the great blue heron is so blue, and I really hope I see a purple martin because like that's such a beautiful purple color. And then size, you know, they do such a good job to list like the inches or the feet and how much it is. And the thing about going out into the world and trying to find birds that way, find them and then tell what it is that depending on the time of day, the lighting that you're utilizing can really skew what you're looking at. So like if you're trying to get out early to really in the spring to catch all of those like all of the warblers on their nesting ground with their beautiful songs, the sun is really coming up, and so it's making everything yellow and orange. And so that the white on the cerulean warbler may look yellow and blue and not white and blue. And so you're like, I've totally discovered a new bird to science. I have no idea what it is. I've done that so many times with birds where it's like, this has to be something so crazy. But then, you know, if you think about, oh, well, the color is probably off because of this time of day. And then same thing with size, like depending on your perception of how far the bird is away from you or how fast it's moving, the size can really change in your mind's eye. So that can be really challenging. So what I like to tell people after you've kind of gotten your feet wet and like trying to go out birding a few times is if you can train your brain instead of trying to pick out color and size, if you think about the absence of light and dark or the different proportions on the bird. So instead of its overall size, it's like how far does the head stick out from its body? How long is its tail? Are the wings curved or are they more straight? So kind of like no matter how close or far away the bird is to you, the parts of its body will never change. And so those are things that really have helped me. I know we were talking about Sharpshin and Cooper's Hawks before we started recording. And I remember my second time when I worked at Hawk Mountain, I was working in the fall and I was still really getting good at identifying raptors while standing up on the lookout. And that was nice because you're on a ridge, so the birds are coming right at you. So you had a lot of time to be like, okay, I see this speck and it's getting closer to me. And I can really think about all of these things. But I had other coworkers that we'd be driving and a bird would zip in front of the car and they'd be like, oh, that was a Sharpshin hawk. And I had the same thing you did. I was like, you're a liar. There's no way you know that. That's crazy. But and then also just seeing it so many times really helps you. So like with the Sharpshin and Cooper's hawks, Sharpshins are the smaller birds. They have smaller proportions. The Cooper's hawks are larger, so they have larger proportions. So that kind of changes like their head projection and what their wing shape looks like. And also their plumage is slightly different. Like Sharpshin hawks look dark all the way through because of the heavy streaking. So it's not necessarily that they look brown. It's just that from their head all the way down through their abdomen, they all look one shade of dark. But the Cooper's hawk, more dense streaking on their heads, less streaking on their chest in through their stomach. So they look like they have dark heads and light chests. So that's like different ways to utilize that. So that's, yeah, once again, another long answer, but I guess I have so much to say about raptor ID and bird ID.
No, it's so interesting. And that was my journey, was you look for color, you look for size. And once you're out of those, you know, it's why I have trouble IDing shorebirds. Like, what kind of gull is that? Who knows? Oh, no one knows, you know? And then I went out with the guides at this birding fest, and from, you know, 300 yards away, they're like, oh, that's two of these and one of these and one juvenile, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, how do you know? And it just, it was so inspirational, because it was never offered as, I see this, how do you not see this? It was offered as, isn't this beautiful and interesting? Let me show you some ways to understand these things. I remember someone in the group said, one of the best ways to improve in your bird ID is when you see something you see all the time, like a house finch, don't say, oh, it's just a house finch. Look at it, study how it flies, because that will help you differentiate when it's not a house finch next time. And I loved that piece of advice. You guys had so many nuggets of goodness.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. That's another thing is, even, I first heard this from, Michael O'Brien, who lives in Cape May and has written lots of bird books and does guiding for Vent. But, we were up at morning flight at Higbee, and I think it was my first fall. And so, like, lots of people that when they first visit Higbee during migration, you're like, how does anyone count all these birds? How do they even know what these small warblers are? And that's how I felt. I was like, oh my God, I thought just identifying the warbler song, the full one, was good. But, and there were tons of robins flying over, and he was like, okay, so we're seeing all of these other birds, and I know everyone's really pumped about, you know, the small warblers, but be sure, even whenever you've decided that that's a robin, watch how it's flying away from you. Cause then, you know, and also it helps if you can categorize your birding experience by chunks of time. So like, okay, in the early fall, you know, to expect these birds, and they're very common this time of year, but by storing every angle in which you've ever seen that bird, like flying away from you, flying towards you, like, you know, sitting on the ground, up high in the tree, even though it's common, you see it in your backyard. That is what's going to help you pick out more uncommon things, is if you are really have that catalog going in your brain where you can easily dismiss all those. So yeah, that was another key piece of, like, it kind of made it more manageable in my mind, of instead of like, oh my gosh, I'll never be able to know all of these things. It's like, oh, well, no, like, you can learn something new every day, even if it's a bird that you see all the time. Like, you could observe a new thing about a song sparrow, and it can help you identify that from a henslow sparrow or something like that, you know? So,
ooh, yeah. Sparrow ID for me is on par with gull ID.
Sparrows? No. Yeah, still working.
Well, Adele, tell us a little bit about the count spots, because Cape May is also unique, and it has three really different spots where you can go and count birds. And as part of the festival, we got to visit some of these spots, but there were people stationed at each of these spots that were there for 8, 10, 12 hours a day for weeks. Tell us about those three spots, and why are we counting birds?
So in the fall, because as we already kind of talked about, it's a crazy migration time. And because of that, we have our three watches. The one that starts first is our morning flight count. Historically, it's the start date has kind of moved around over the last couple years, but now it starts August 1st and runs through November 15th or 14th, the first 2 weeks. So it ends there. And the main focus of that count is to really try to grasp the giant swath of birds that are moving through, specifically warblers. So we have a morning flight counter that works 6 days a week. That is, the counter spends max 30 hours a week counting. And overall, we now have a migration monitoring coordinator, Tom Reed. So I do all of the education, and he oversees all of the research. So anytime that I talk about the counter not being there, Tom is the one swing counting, which is very impressive, because to be able to count at morning flight, hawk watch, and sea watch, like, to be able to understand all of those and like catalog them correctly is very impressive. So, but our morning flight counter spends 6 days a week. He gets there at sunrise and stays, maximum 6 hours throughout the day from the start of sunrise. And is really trying to, to really count all of the, to positively identify and count all of the warblers and really anything that flies by. Like I mentioned before, we utilize Trek Telen. So if you are staying in Cape May, or if you are just want to know what's going on and at what site, you can go on to trektellen.org and the totals are live streamed. Like as soon as the counter hits send, then it's up on the website. So if you're wondering if it's better to go to Higby or the Hawk Watch early in the morning, you can look at that. And because the counter can so easily log those numbers, we also they also count like brant and gulls and raptors. Not this past fall, but two falls ago, I was up on Higby and I got to see a goshawk, which I hadn't seen in multiple years because they're really hard to see. We had some more goshawks fly by this fall also from Higby. So yeah, and that's, and a lot of the times the morning flight counter is counting individual birds or flocks of birds as they're flying over. But whenever you go on to Trektellen and see that we've counted tens of thousands of birds, a lot of that is there is a line. Like if you've ever been up on the morning flight, it is up on a dredge spoil up in Higby Beach Wildlife Management Area. So it gives you a elevated view of the bay, as well as behind us is a water tower. And so there can just be flocks and flocks of thousands of birds going. And so they'll do a minute count of all of the birds they can see. And then they'll do a rate of passage so that that person can turn around and focus on all the other things going. And then after 10 minutes, they'll check the rate of passage again to see if they need to adjust their flow. So it definitely, it would be great if we could count, like accurately count every single, you know, species or bird that's going by. And so the counts are being done as accurately as the mass of birds will allow us. And what's really cool, I'll also say this about all of the sites, is since they've all been established, Morning Flight was established in 1993, they all of the tools and how the protocols of how these counts are run has stayed the same. So each fall, they're all done to the same what is the word? I gotta think about the same accuracy. I've like said this same thing so many times.
Specification.
Yes, thank you. Specifications. Okay, yeah. I'll just start that over again.
Go for it.
But something else I want to say about all of the sites is that since the year that each of them was started, Morning Flight was started in 1993, each of the protocols and specifications and the need for accuracy has been passed on to each of the counters. So it is a trusted database of migration numbers just because we've all of the counters have been doing it the same way since then. And then if we were going to move from August 1st, the start of morning flight at Higby Beach Wildlife Management Area, the next count that would start is our Hawk Watch. So the Cape May Hawk Watch, which started in 1976 and takes place at the Cape May Point State Park, which starts on September 1st. Also up north, up at our Montclair site, we have another Hawk Watch that starts also on September 1st, and they're more of a ridge site. So they always beat us with Broadwing Hawk numbers. They saw over 10,000 in one day, which hasn't happened in a while. I don't know the full number off the top of my head, but it was really impressive. They had a really great year this year. So we don't really get the same number of Broadwings as they do, but our Hawk Watch counter starts September 1st down here and up at Montclair, and both counts run through the end of November. So they end on November 30th. And those counts both focus on the 13 different species of raptors that fly by. But additionally, we do count lots of other things because of the tablet allowing us to really input all that data. We also tend to, I saw a humpback whale from the Hawk Watch in, I think that was November. And we sometimes, if it's really slow with birds, we'll also count like dolphins and things like that. Like anything that goes by, we can kind of log. We also, the counters also count monarch butterflies as well, or dragonflies. So yeah, that's kind of the Hawk Watch is really the epicenter of like not just raptor migration, but it's a great spot for people to come and if you're local to really see your friends and talk about the sightings. But also if you've never been to Cape May, I hire three interpretive naturalists in the fall, and also our George Myers naturalist, the position that I mentioned earlier, they are also helping talk to all of the visitors that spend time up mainly at the Hawk Watch. We see around 28,000 people at the Cape May Hawk Watch every fall, and then across the that site and also Morning Flight and Sea Watch, I think we hit over 30,000 people, which is really cool. So it's really important that we have those naturalists out there to answer all of the questions, whether it's bird related or not. You know, and we always greet people, and we have the Hawk Watch is also sponsored by Swarovski Optics. So we have three sets of binoculars and two sets of scopes for people to borrow and utilize on the platform. So we try to foster a kind of sense of, you know, if you really want to learn about birds and you are welcome here, and please ask us your questions. And it can be really fun when it's a really busy day up on the Hawk Watch and there's just thermals of like dozens or maybe even hundreds of birds flying above you, and there's just people pointing out all kinds of crazy stuff. It's like really electric, I would say, is like the best word I can say. And it kind of really exemplifies like peak bird community, I would say. Like, it's very, very fun.
It's Disneyland for birders. It really is. I called my husband and I told him I wasn't coming home.
Yeah. It's just like,
I'm gonna live here now.
Yes. And like, even if there isn't anything flying, we have Bunker Pond out in front of us. So there's probably a kingfisher out on the poles, or, you know, we've got, you know, lots of mute swans, which is a really great, you know, conservation topic we can always talk about, or, you know, lots of ducks and all kinds of stuff. There's been bitterns that will fly across at like any moment's notice. So there's always something going on. And I guess with that, the last watch is our Avalon Sea Watch, which the tagline for Avalon is cooler by a mile. So you may be wondering why our other sites are on Cape Island and why this one would be all the way up 13 miles up the parkway. And the reason is because we're counting mainly seabirds there. This year, we actually counted over 1 million seabirds. And by we, I mean Daniel Irons, who is our Sea Watch counter, and Tom Reed, who I mentioned before. And that count runs from October 1st to December 22nd. This is the first year, actually, that the count started on October 1st. Previously, it always started on September 22nd, but we found that with, you know, the switch of temperature kind of skewing warmer later, we were just really, the counter was spending 13-hour days because that count starts at sunrise and goes till sunset. So it's like a brutal time on the beach, just really answering a lot of questions about why we aren't selling ice cream. And then also just counting like gulls and some other things that weren't necessarily migrating or like behaving how they were supposed to behave. So we took a leap and we started it October 1st, and we were pleasantly surprised that with those last like less days of the watch, we still hit 1 million birds, which is only the third time that that's ever happened in the history of the count. So and that was officially started in 2003. So so it's very cool. It happens, and the reason why we do it at Avalon is because these seabirds are flying out over the water. Double-crested cormorants there are certain species that will fly that aren't shy of land, but most of them, like the sea ducks and the gannets and all kinds of things, they don't want to be out over land. So the farther out we can be over the ocean, the better. So that saying of Avalon being cooler by a mile, it sticks out a mile farther from mainland than the other barrier islands. So if you think about running a straight line down the coast of Jersey, by the time, if those birds are going straight, by the time they make it to Cape May, we kind of bend inward And so they're staying out over the water and we don't have nearly as good of a view of them from shore. So we still do count seabirds from Hawkwatch. We count them from morning flight, but the density of them, how many we see, is way less than at Avalon. So in contrary to the best day to go to this, to the Hawkwatch or morning flight would be on a northwest wind, like I mentioned earlier. The best time for sea watching is whenever the Hawkwatch is dead, which is, it's a southeast wind. So it's really pushing those birds closer to the shoreline, and really gets them, you know, closer views. So we partner with the town of Avalon, and they actually now provide us with a shack that is set up on the beach for our counter. It's between the 8th and 9th Street jetties of Avalon. Historically, our counters would just hang out in their cars at the seawall or like outside on the seawall, counting the birds as they flew by with no shelter and no bathroom. And now we have a we have two porta potties and a shack and a bus stop bench as well. So we're really living the life of luxury out there.
It is straight up swanky.
Yeah.
So swanky.
They spend all day counting tens of thousands of birds. Out of all like of the million that I mentioned, there are five main species that are the top. So there's two types of scoters, the black scoter and surf scoter, which are sea ducks, as well as red-throated loons, northern gannets, and double-crested cormorants. So those are the ones that really make up 80% of the birds counted past Avalon. So yeah. And yeah, those are all of our count sites. And our naturalists that I mentioned, they are hired between September 1st and the end of October. So their last day is Halloween. And so that's really whenever we see the bulk of our visitorship to all of the watches. So if you visit Cape May and during that time period and you hang out on one of our watches, most likely there will always be someone at the Hawkwatch. And if you're there early at Higbee before October 14th, then you'll find one of our naturalists. And kind of towards the end of October is whenever I start putting people up at Sea Watch, because it really starts getting good. The seabird migration, as you notice, it goes till December 22nd. So it gets better as the fall goes on. So.
And it's such a wonderful community resource because that's free. You can just walk up, you can chat up a naturalist, you can have your questions answered. You know, there's a fee for the bird festival itself because there's so many additional things that are part of that. But to know that you can have kids in the area or you can be traveling to, you know, Cape May for a late summer vacation to eat good saltwater taffy and also learn so much. It's such a gift to the community. It's a wonderful thing you guys do.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and it's so amazing. Like, especially like how I mentioned, we have 28,000 people that visit the Hawkwatch. It's free because we partner with the state park. It's their property and they don't charge anybody to come into the park. And what also is really cool, like how I loved working at my first Hawkwatch job at Hawk Mountain. But what's so different in comparison to a ridge site is that, you know, you park your car and then is a sanctuary, so there is a fee associated with it, and then you have to walk 1 mile up, you know, a rocky mountain to then be at North Lookout to see the beauty of migration. And with the Cape May Hawkwatch, people don't even know they're up there most of the time if they aren't birders, because you can just pull into the parking lot, walk up a ramp, and then you're on deck. You're watching these birds fly by, and it's so unique and so cool. And we engage with so many people that don't even realize that birds are migrating, or you know, that we're doing this research up there. So it really is in partnership with the state park and Swarovski, especially, like being able to really engage people with optics as well is really cool. So, and our volunteers spend time also not only helping me with our programming, but also just hanging out on the watches, like talking to people. It just helps bring together the community aspect there. So,
So the fall Bird Fest is amazing. Everyone should go. Yeah. But we're headed towards spring. Yes. Tell us, put in a plug for the Spring Birding Festival.
Our Spring Festival this year is going to be May 16th to May 19th. Registration to the public is going to launch on February 15th. And we'll be open around like until the first week of May, maybe like between May 4th and May 10th. We'll keep it open. Or we do have a chance of selling out. So if you're thinking about coming, please be sure to really check out the link as soon as possible, just because we have a lot going on. Our festivals are a lot of fun. We, my program department team at the Bird Observatory work with Lillian and Shannon on our special events team to help with the programming. But we have a full weekend of outdoor programming and also indoor programs and talks, as well as a really cool keynote this year and all kinds of stuff. So that's for our festival. And also, I have to say, what makes me the most excited, I know I've kind of talked about Cape May and the birding community in general, but really what allows us to do so much and to impact so many people are all of our volunteers. I have about like 3.5 people in my program department that help me not only run the programs, but also do all of the behind the scenes work, putting up all of our programs online. But we do over 250 programs every year, which includes all of our festival programming. And so it's really my core group of about 20 volunteers that live down here and that are running most of our programs. So I do help weekly with programs throughout the spring to fall. Winter is kind of our more calm time, but it's more likely that you'll run into one of my wonderful volunteers out there. So we're super grateful. And yeah, it just makes it even more special down here to go out birding with them, because they have so much more knowledge.
So Adele, we have come to the hardest question of the podcast. You've been an amazing guest. I don't want to throw you for a loop here, but here it is. Here it comes. What is your favorite bird?
Oh my gosh. Well, I do have a favorite bird, and it is also my spark bird. It's really what got me into birding, and it is the turkey vulture, which I know might be a little controversial to people. However, there are so many amazing things that make vultures vultures. And I just remember, like, whenever, like I said, I worked at Hawk Mountain, and we would be standing up at North Lookout, and people would really want to see, you know, a bald eagle or a red-tailed hawk or something. And they'd be like, oh, they call this Hawk Mountain and there's no hawks. And then there'd be vultures circling. I'd be like, well, there are raptors. And I would go on and on and on about how cool vultures were. So I just think they're the most elegant birds, and that they go unnoticed a lot of the times because of their ecological job that they do. And also just they're not – people say they're not beautiful, but if you've ever watched a vulture – fly, I have a hard time believing you when you say they aren't beautiful. So that is definitely my overall favorite bird. So
I love a turkey vulture. We have a lot of turkey vultures here. I think they're the janitors of the bird world, but they're also the priests. There's something about like holding vigil over these dead animals in this kind of beautiful, holy way. I love a vulture.
Yeah. Irish. Exactly. So cool.
All right. Final question. You're doing all this work in conservation. You're seeing amazing, beautiful things, but you're also seeing, oh goodness, this bird population is in decline. Oh goodness, we had more of these last year. You know, it's a mixed bag. And in light of that, where are you finding hope these days?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think I find hope in all, in like our new, not new demographic, but we've noticed like through our program department, like since I've started and even a little bit before that, we used to have a lot more member, like we still have lots of members that attend our programming, but now the split is like half members, half new people that aren't members. And also our festival, we bring in lots of new birders as well as really experienced birders. So I think like the influx of people that I've talked to that are like, oh, wow, like I really, my eyes have been open to how cool not only birding is, but just how beautiful like nature is. So I think it can be challenging. I know like society and kind of how our or how we are engineered to work is, you know, we kind of think about ourselves being separate from nature. And I think I just see a shift in people realizing that we're actually a part of it and we can cause positive change. Like, not just like, I know it can be really daunting to think about all like on a large scale, since we are so connected through social media and the news and all kinds of things, but you can make a really big impact in your neighborhood, which will then no doubt make a larger impact in your county and then in your state and all those things. So I think that's really what gives me hope, is like meeting so many people that are newly excited about birding, and the more people that are excited about the outdoors, the better, because then it just will lead to more beautiful change, no matter what that looks like. So,
oh, yeah. I love it. I love it. I love it. I was surprised. You know, there is kind of that stereotype that birding is for old retired white people. Yes. And the birding festival was very diverse. Like, there were people my age and younger, and there were people of every race. And, you know, there were a lot of retired old white people, but that's going to be me someday. So I'm not mad about it. But it really was diverse. And I met a lot of people from all over the country and from all different walks of life. And that was a beautiful thing.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So, well, it's going to be great. I'm very excited for another busy year of programming, especially the festival. So it'll be fun.
It was amazing. Highly, highly recommend a visit to Cape May. If you can attend one of the bird festivals, it will change your life. Go find Adele. She'll tell you about raptors and vultures, which are also raptors, which I did not know before this podcast. So I'm learning things here. I will link to registration for the festival. I'll also link to Trek Tellen, which, if you're not at the festival, but you want to see how many birds are coming in, it's a really fun, I just keep it up on my computer all the time. My husband laughs at me. I just want to know. I want to know. And I will link to the other resources she mentioned, but check out Cape May, think about the festival. And Adele, thank you so much for the gift of your time.
Yeah, of course. Thank you all so much for listening. Thank you again for having me, Courtney. This was so fun. I love talking about birds. So thank you all so much. And I hope you get to see something cool outside today after you're done listening. So
The Thing with Feathers is produced by me, Courtney Ellis. Many thanks to Del Belcher for the music, to Todd Peterson for the name inspiration, and to Emily Dickinson for the beautiful poem and for being in the public domain. Until next time, my friends, keep looking up.
What is going on your soul? Yes, it does.